Excellent, me. That's a read I can live with. It is, what is it? 5 after 6 a.m. Good morning, everybody. It's the Jason Rants Show. Brian Suits filling in for Jason. And we ended yesterday with a little bit of some Putin audio from the questions after the press conference in Helsinki. It's been, I guess, 21 hours since that dropped, as they say in music. And we're starting to see some of the bounce back. Overall, it appears that even some, in fact, many conservatives are ranging from horrified to beclowned in regards to what happened in Helsinki yesterday. And one of them, and I guess this is sort of what the bottom line is, before I go down a list of usual suspects that you might expect, Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, and Kevin McCarthy, the guy who should be Speaker, because Ryan's not running again and he should have stepped aside. But regardless, they both released statements in support of the American intelligence community and denouncing Putin and what happened in Helsinki. Just to wrap you up, if you didn't see it, and I have no idea how you didn't see this anywhere in conservative media yesterday, but at the one point asked about the election and the whole thing, Trump said that he trusts Vladimir Putin over the American intelligence community. And this is where a lot of conservative talk and discussion has sprayed crazy juice over itself over the past year and a half, with this this belief that there is some super secret cabal running everything from the FBI to the NSA. And instead of what it really is, which is a dedicated career professionals who, guess what, have a diversity of opinions. Sometimes conservatives are the administrators, sometimes they're not. there's no doubt whatsoever that former CIA director John Brennan is a really horrible person. So I'm not gonna retweet what he says about Trump, because he's the guy who went pretty much full idiot yesterday talking about treason and et cetera. Fine, bring your charges. But when an American president stands next to Vladimir Putin and sides with Putin and says what Trump said, which is, well, he told me strongly that he didn't do it, he didn't interfere with the election. There's another word for that, and it's naivete and even stupidity, but it's not treason. But don't tell that to the American left-wing media. As the night wore on last night, I couldn't help but go back to college, go back into the 80s, when the Cold War was at its high tide, Ronald Reagan was the president, and I'm walking to class at Wazoo in my Navy ROTC uniform, and I get confronted by people, either in class or walking around, about how can I support Reagan's war machine, and that the Reagan wants war. And there were even people saying that it's the Soviets that are the greatest force for peace in the world today. And I go back to that, and I realize I'm seeing some of those same people now, older, and they're the ones who are lecturing me all about how we should trust our intelligence community and the whole thing. And that, don't you understand what a bad guy Putin is? And it's useless for me to say back to them, yes, I do understand. I'm the guy who's been saying this since the 80s about Russia, not the Soviet Union, but about Russia. And it's really weird how your support of the intelligence community became so strident and full-throated later on in the afternoon that Trump became president. But when Bush was president, you literally are the ones who came up with the deep state theory that somehow people in the American intelligence community were taking direct payments from Lockheed, Northrop, Boeing, Bushmaster, Armalite, Winchester, something. I don't know. But, you know, find a stance and stick to it. Me, I have. And it's that American foreign policy is what I support. When it's not good, I talk about it in private. Whether it's a president of the United States, whether it's Obama or Trump, I know this. You don't go overseas. You don't kowtow to foreign leaders. You don't badmouth the United States. You don't badmouth the other party. And this is the bottom line. If Obama had done what Trump did yesterday, what would we be saying on conservative radio today? That's the end of the debate. So everyone just reset and get sane. Here's the deal. I do a weekly hit on Fox News with my friend Kennedy. Tonight is my hit, 5 p.m. Pacific. Every week I'm on Fox News. And every week it's gone, because I am very critical of this administration's naivete about North Korea, because, spoiler alert, North Korea is not denuclearizing. Whatever that means, it hasn't translated into Korean or North Korean, for that matter. It's practically a different language. And it's been a ticking time bomb, because at some point, somebody has to go into that Oval Office and break the news to Donald Trump, a guy who had absolutely no background in nuclear proliferation theory or nuclear weapons technology theory or any of that. Somebody has to break the news to him that this is a little different than getting a gambling license in New Jersey, which is a yes, no, pass, go, no, go, pass, fail thing. Someone has to break the news to him that North Korea has no intention of getting rid of their nuclear weapons. And whatever you think was said in Singapore, whatever it was not a promise to denuclearize. We're still waiting for that other shoe to drop. In this case, this is real simple. This is really, really simple. All I can say is, if Newt Gingrich can get this right, then you all too can get it right. This is what he said yesterday, quote, "President Trump must clarify his statements in Helsinki on our intelligence system and Putin. It is the most serious mistake of his presidency and must be corrected immediately." And again, this is Newt Gingrich, you know, a guy who was begging for a position in this White House. You know, he put on a gimp outfit with a ball gag and the whole deal, and he still didn't get it. And that guy, the say what you will about Newt, like I just did, at least he was here for the Cold War. At least he was in Congress when there was a Soviet Union. At least the guy has taken the measure of the nation, Russia, versus the older nation, Soviet Union, and he's realized that the actions of the Soviet Union deep down were the actions that would be taken by Russia anyway. And so I give him credit there. But for a lot of people, this is it's been a fairly stunning 24 hours to me. I made the joke, and I don't even want to replay it, but I just made the joke yesterday that if you have friends in Alaska, you might want to have them pack a bag, because Trump might trade Alaska for a bag of magic beans. It was just a joke, just a joke. But there's really not a way that you can defend Trump's mastery of this kind of interaction. Putin played him. We're now in damage control mode. And what I really dislike about this is the fact that now the far left on TV is acting like they've been saying this all along about Vladimir Putin. Really, really weird. When Obama was president, none of this was said. And in fact, when Mitt Romney said it, he was roundly mocked from Obama on down, from a televised debate. And then it cascaded down like the meerkats in Lion King. Or no, they're hyenas. I'm sorry, the bad guys were the hyenas in Lion King. So then what happened yesterday? Here's a little bit of a montage from Newsbusters. This is MSNBC and CNN. And you're going to hear a whole lot of Anderson Cooper. Anderson Cooper looked, and I don't know, producer Darren, by the way, who's there at the other end as a part of the show. I don't know if you were monitoring CNN during that, but he did actually look shocked. He looked like someone came up. He looked like Kathy Griffin came up and slapped him in the face.
I mean,
were you watching CNN?
I wasn't. I just watched the montage you're talking about. But he looked genuinely distraught.
Yeah, I was taking the CBS feed.
I hope somebody checked on him this morning.
I know. And then at 9 a.m., you know, we bailed after the second or third question. Some other good stuff happened, you know, after the show. I did not check in on Anderson Cooper, and I don't know if he's face down in a sauna in Helsinki with an empty bottle of vodka stuck somewhere. I don't know.
It would be a better place, according to how he's feeling.
Yeah, and have you heard his laugh?
I have.
Yeah. I can't even imitate it. Here's a little bit of the Newsbusters montage.
On stage left in Helsinki alongside the President of the United States, who had nothing but warm words for the time that they spent together.
First of all, I just have to say I'm sick to my stomach. I'm really
feeling nauseous.
Stunned. Gobsmacked.
We're hearing words like, I feel sick. This is frightening. Calling it an abomination.
Shocking.
Stunning.
Genuinely stunning.
What is going on? Unbelievable.
Astonishing. Just astonishing.
This is Acosta and Anderson Cooper.
Astonishing. It's heartbreaking, and it represents, I think, a pivotal turn in our nation's history.
It's time for Americans to be out on the street.
There are people...
And let me... And the Newsbusters added the soundtrack. Let me just call someone out on this. In this montage...
Time for Americans to be out on the street.
That's Jill Stein. That's Jill frickin' Stein, who's upset about Trump in Helsinki with Putin. She was a guest of honor at a 10th anniversary dinner for RT, the Russian propaganda channel. She literally sat at the same table with Putin. What the hell is she talking about this? We'll be back in just a minute. Simon Owen from Fox will join us, actually, from Helsinki with some more reaction. Closer to Ground Zero, that and more coming up. It is the Jason Rand Show. Brian Toots filling in. AM 770 KTTH, Jason Rand Show for a Tuesday morning. Brian Toots filling in. And we have the most distracted drivers in the entire state of Washington. That is on deck. And then also the most the place with more 911 calls than anywhere else in Seattle. And it should be the last place, but it's the first place. More on that a little later on. And right now, Simon Owen for Fox News is packing his bags and on his way to the airport, I'm assuming. And still in Helsinki. Are you flying out today?
Good morning. Flying back tomorrow.
Oh, there you go. It's a lovely town. It really is, actually, in spite of why you're there. It really is a great town. So now we're almost 24 hours since the big event. Let me ask, what is the European reaction, and specifically the NATO reaction to what happened yesterday?
Well, I mean, the Europeans aren't saying very much, and I wouldn't expect them to, because this is an issue between the United States and Russia. But I think in some ways they'll be quite, you know, satisfied. Maybe potentially they go as far as saying relieved in terms of what played out, because, you know, President Putin did not manage to get President Trump to agree that Crimea in Ukraine should be Russian territory, which is the area of Ukraine that Russia seized 4 years ago. He didn't get President Trump to lift sanctions, and he didn't get President Trump to rein back a pledge to modernize the United States nuclear weapons, which is going to set off a very expensive arms race, this race between Russia and the United States. So President Putin didn't get many concessions, and I think the Europeans will be satisfied with that. The criticism, as I imagine you may have seen, is all coming from the United States, because the subject where President Trump really courted controversy was where it came to election meddling. This was his chance, if he wanted to take it, to have Vladimir Putin by his side and say, look, U.S. intelligence says you meddled in my election. This must not happen again. And President Trump decided against doing that.
And as you recall, in 2016, it was Obama said he was going to tell Putin to, quote, knock it off, close quote. So, we don't know what happened behind closed doors with Trump and Putin. But apparently the Putin wasn't sufficiently warned off by Obama's dire threat. So the meeting went on for it was supposed to be an hour and a half. It went on for nearly 4 hours. Is there any inside poop on what they really did talk about for nearly 4 hours?
Well, I mean, the whole thing was 2 hours, but some of that there were advisors present. But for at least 2 hours, it was just the two presidents with only translators joining them in the room. And unless those translators break their vow of silence, we're unlikely to ever really find out what they talked about. I mean, the leaders said that they discussed Syria, Ukraine, North Korea, Iran, you know, all the global security crises of the day. And they both said they also discussed election meddling. And this is where President Trump said, he just said, it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be. And the president said he had great confidence in his intelligence people. He said, I'll tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today. So it appeared to be the president accepting President Putin's denial over his own intelligence experts.
And then Putin's statement, he came out and to him, some of his foreign policy priorities are the resolution of things in Syria. It appears that Bashar Assad is not going anywhere. And then secondly, he came out denouncing Trump's dropping the Iran deal. So is that a pretty accurate reflection of what he talked about back there, or were they just chummy and backslapping?
No, I mean, I think there were big disputes, and the election meddling was always going to be the big subject. But I think it was also striking how they listed this sort of shopping list of crises that they talked about: Syria, Ukraine, Iran. And for all these two leaders saying they want to improve U.S.-Russia relations, those are three big crises where they're on totally different pages as to how to resolve them. And you can add nuclear weapons to that as well. There is no sign of any kind of breakthrough on any of those areas. You know, they talked for hours, as you say, but they didn't really have much to report in terms of agreements. And that is potentially going to be a problem, I suspect. They both said that this is step one towards improving U.S.-Russia relations. President Trump said he believes U.S.-Russia relations had never been worse. So they both said they wanted to see that improve. But when they talked about the big crises, they're very much a long way apart. And it suggested to me that there was that there wasn't much breakthrough and not much hope for them coming any closer. And so in the meantime, they're going to remain on different pages on these really big pressing global issues.
And then some last question. Sometimes at the end of these kind of things, even though this one was very informal, with no prior agenda, they usually announce if there's a follow-on meeting. Is there any rumor of 6 months from now, another one-on-one meeting, anything like that?
No, there's not. And whether President Trump is ready to invite President Putin to the White House, I suspect that would be a step too far. My hunch is that, you know, this has been, not much came out of this one. And so maybe they've set things in place and their officials can follow up on it in the coming months. And then they'll turn around and say, okay, we've had 6 months, let's have another meeting. It's time, you know, we've made progress on these issues. And this time, yeah, there will be a set agenda. And we'll see what we can come up with in terms of agreed, you know, fixed points to take forward. But at the moment, I'm not sure there's too much to follow up on from this, except a desire to keep these going. So there will be times at various international summits down over the next months and a couple of years when they will both be there, and it would, you'd have thought they would presumably keep having what they call pull-aside meetings, short one-on-one meetings. Whether there is enough there to actually have everybody make the effort to come all the way to another country like Finland, just for a discussion about, you know, President Trump saying that he backs Vladimir Putin's assessment about election meddling, I don't know if they feel that was worth doing that again. But as they both say that this is step one, and they are miles apart on some big issues, so they're going to have to talk again if there's going to be any breakthrough. I suppose it's what can the officials do in the interim?
Yeah. All right. Well, Simon Owen, grab a liquid souvenir and make your flight. And thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. There you go. Simon Owen for Fox News. Brian Suits filling in for Jason Rance on the Jason Rance Show. We'll be back in just a second. Wait till you hear where the most 911 calls in Seattle originate from right after this on AM 770 KTTH. Let's get you to traffic the right way with Right Way Traffic. Welcome back, AM 770 KTTH, the Jason Rance Show. Brian Suits filling in for Jason Rance. We'll take a deep dive coming up a little bit. A really interesting story on King 5 about the progress of charter schools in the state of Washington and what is standing in the way of progress in charter schools. And also that it very well might be if your kids are possibly about to be sentenced to underperforming public schools and they're failing you and your neighborhood, it very well might be that the billionaires are coming to save ye, which is interesting because the billionaires, one guy in particular who went to Lakeside School because his father is an extremely wealthy lawyer in Seattle, he can send his kids to the Lakeside School. But this guy, this Bill Gates chap, is donating money left and right, and not Gates Foundation money, but his personal money. He and Melinda are donating money to various charter projects in the West, and because of that, you just might be able to send your kid to a far better school than the union-run schools. They're probably just located around the corner. Real quickly, citizens fighting back. We always have to highlight these stories just so that people do hear them. So you hear them and you go to work, and whenever your friends say, well, you know, you never hear about firearms actually, anyone actually defending themselves with a firearm because they just shoot themselves in the head with them and the whole thing. Well, anyway, not in Ballard. Minutes after a Ballard homeowner called 911 early Sunday to report that he had shot at an intruder, a man was dropped off at a Ballard hospital with a gunshot wound to the abdomen, according to the Seattle Popo. The homeowner was sleeping when he heard what sounded like someone breaking into his house on 25th Northwest around 4:15 a.m. He armed himself with a handgun, found an intruder who had already broken into an enclosed mudroom and was trying to break into the main house. The homeowner fired a round through a door into the mudroom, then called 911 when officers responded. Neighbors said a dark-colored station wagon drove away from the victim's house at a rapid rate of speed. 10 minutes later, police were notified the 35-year-old man with a gunshot wound arrived at Swedish Ballard. The injured man was taken to Harborview. His condition on Monday was unknown. Several blocks away, officers came across a man and woman standing outside of the dark-colored station wagon. They saw fresh blood inside and outside of the vehicle. Putting two and two together, they questioned the couple. The car also appeared to contain stolen property. The two were detained and questioned. Officers arrested the man because he had an outstanding warrant. SadTrombone.com. Also, the woman who is the sister of the man who was shot was interviewed and released. I'm sure she had absolutely no idea of the purpose of her brother asking to be driven around Ballard at 4:15 a.m., nor even why he came running back saying, I need to get to an ER. So now, by the way, I don't know how King County prosecutor is going to look at this. Washington is in Texas, and I know that in the past, King County prosecutors, if someone uses a firearm, because they can articulate that they felt the threat, it's usually hands off. So whoever the resident is there at 25th Northwest in Ballard, I have a really, really good gun lawyer for you right here in the Seattle area. And you might, but just remember that phrase. I felt a direct threat to my life or family, to my family and myself. Get in front of a King County jury. Bob's your uncle, as they say. After months and months of study, here's where we are with Third Avenue. Seattle police report that the place in their jurisdiction in all of Seattle that receives the most 911 calls, King County Courthouse. Following months of pleas for help from frustrated judges and court staff, Seattle police increased patrols around the KC Courthouse. For more than a month, bike, horse patrol, foot beat, narco officers, all of them have been patrolling the neighborhood in response to the reports of violence. This is from Channel 4 News. I forgot their call letters. Anyway, it's on, it's Channel 4. For more than a month. Is that what it is?
Come on. Yep.
Yeah. Nice. No. Forgot. Slipped my mind. They've been patrolling the Third Avenue region of King County Courthouse in response to the reports of violence, threats, and lewd behavior. And this has been a problem area for decades. This used to be just the northern edge of Pioneer Square, and you only got the hobos who could make it uphill. And I just have to say hobos because as everyone recalls, the term Skid Row, the original Skid Row, literally was Jackson. It literally, in America, if anyone ever says Skid Row, that was originally in Seattle. It was where they slid the logs downhill to Elliott Bay. So the hobos who can make it from Skid Row up to the courthouse because it's uphill, that used to be the upper edge, but now they inhabit it. So it is now, according to court staff and Seattle police, it is the most 911'd place in all of Seattle. According to court staff, a man assaulted at least three people on June 19th. On June 28th, the court staffer said they were hit in the arm and elbow while walking near the entrance on 4th Avenue. And also in that report, a staffer said a man on a bicycle struck them with a metal rod. Superior Court Judge Sean O'Donnell says he's talked to city and county council members about threats and violence. Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin is aware of the problem. And keep in mind that the U.S. attorney, whoever that was, they're in a different federal building. Okay. I mean, you could throw a baseball and hit Seattle Police Headquarters from the new federal building. So perhaps her visibility on the plight of King County Courthouse is not as clear as possibly it should be. Fire engines, medic units, police cars can regularly be found parked in front of the downtown emergency service center. The judge, O'Donnell, said, quote, "We've heard from jurors who don't feel safe, who might not regularly come to downtown Seattle and see the conditions here, and they're frightened." Emily Elder was on jury duty Monday when she looked across the street from the courthouse steps toward the emergency services center. The soon-to-be graduate student said her father drove her to court from Issaquah to make sure she'd be safe. He was worried about the surrounding area, and he wanted me to be safe. So listen, by the way, listen to this deal. You know, keep in mind, there's the old saying that a jury are the 12 people who couldn't get out of jury duty. And it's not exactly like that in King County. But what it is like in King County is that there's a huge geographic area of King County that is rural or suburban. And in rural King County, granted, okay, there are meth heads running around on stolen mountain bikes at 4 a.m. But by and large, you go to the east side and you don't see anything even close to the homeless and the aggressive homeless problem in downtown Seattle. Seattle police, there's a slang for the old homeless dudes, the old school homeless guys who just roll around in their feces and don't harm anyone. They're called horns. Well, there's a different breed of cat amongst a lot of homeless in Seattle. And it's the young, aggressive men. Either there is a mental health issue, it's a drug issue, whatever. But Seattle's becoming one of these municipalities where you lose livability because these homeless guys feel like they're in charge and the police are not. So a 78-year-old Woodinville man declined jury duty by letter. In his letter, he told courthouse staff that Seattle, quote, "is terrifying to me. I would have no way of defending myself. I did serve years ago and I was proud to do so. But with the present state of affairs, now I am fearful," close quote. You know what? That's a guy I want on a jury. I want that guy to feel safe in downtown Seattle so he can be on a jury. I don't want the people who need $35 a day to be on a jury. So you fail. King County, you fail. Mayor Durkin, you fail. But of course, you park underground and go right up to your office, and Seattle police are a block away. We'll be back in just a second. Brian's filling in for Jason Rance on the Jason Rance Show, AM 770 KTTH. AM 770 KTTH, the Jason Rance Show. Brian Suits filling in here, 10 minutes approximately till 7 a.m. here in Seattle. Another 90-degree day. Oh, well, enjoy it is what I say. Well, federal courts are going to be deciding the speed, rapidity, and effectiveness of reuniting kids with their detained illegal alien parents. And Tanya J. Powers from Fox News is here to tell us about it. Let's start with this. I can't keep track of all the courts that are dealing with this. Where and which court is this?
That's a really interesting statement you point out there, too, because it sort of is difficult to keep up with everything. This is in San Diego. A district judge has now said that they're going to order this temporary halt to the deportations of the families that have been reunited with the kids. Now, remember, last week was the first deadline for the kids under five. The one coming up on July 26th is the one where a great number of kids are involved in that one, and these are the ones that are over the age of five.
And this is this actually an immigration judge, or is this a Ninth Circuit guy on the West Coast?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure which circuit. I just know that it's a district judge. And this was the one that set the deadlines in the first place.
Yeah.
Yesterday, they were asked by the ACLU, the judge was asked that the parents get at least a week after they're reunited with their kids to decide whether they want to pursue asylum in the U.S., The judge didn't completely decide the issue, but said, okay, we're going to temporarily stop the deportations while I think about this, and I will issue some sort of, you know, ruling on this before Monday.
And then where we were before was another judge had ruled that the U.S. over the past 30 days had displayed a good faith effort to reunite kids with their parents. But so let's take a step back. What's the scale? What are we talking about? How many kids right now are in federal care while their parents are in detention?
There were before the deadlines, both of them. The total number of kids was over 2,500. I think it's 2,551 is the number that the government's given us. If I recall correctly from last week's story, there was about 100 of them, give or take a few, that were under five. That was the first deadline that covered under that deadline. The government missed the deadline. A couple of days later, we learned that the majority of them had been reunited with their parents. From the government's own numbers, I think 12 of them, the parents had already been deported. There were some issues kind of case by case from then on for the rest of them. This time, on the 26th, they have the rest of those. So that would be about 2,400, maybe 2,450 kids to be reunited that are above the age of five. That deadline, like I said, is on July 26th, and that's the one that was given by this judge.
And then I don't know if they've worked these details out. I'm a little mystified. If they reunite them with their parents, is the next stop getting on a bus and being deported, or is it going to a hotel and waiting for a court date that they're not going to show up for, or what?
That's another good question. I mean, the families are kind of scattered around the country, as we already know. The adults were held at immigration centers. The children were overseen at shelters that, you know, are run by a different department. And, you know, we kept hearing about, okay, well, this department's over the kids, this department's over the adults, and that's why there's, you know, difficulty, you know, getting everything coordinated. That kind of thing. Apparently, that's what they were doing, though. As soon as they were reunited with their kids, they were deporting them. And that's the reason the ACLU stepped in and said, wait, you've got to give them at least a chance to, you know, say, hey, we want to pursue asylum or not, because that is what, you know, we've learned that a lot of these people were coming here for, is to ask for asylum to start with.
Well, maybe there can be a drive-through window or something. I don't know. I'm just spitballing here. Don't encourage me. Don't lower my level. All right, Tom DJ Powers from Fox News. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Brian.
Because here's the thing. Lost in this, as I watch this controversy, I have to repeat that. We talked to Simon Owens from Fox News earlier from Helsinki, and he said that's the phrase it pays today is controversy. But as we've watched this controversy, one of the things that's absolutely lost in, and I got to say, conservative media is whiffing on this as well, that this is the implementation of a policy that was on the books, you know, for years. It's a federal court finding that you can't detain children for X amount of time. You can't be detained with an adult, even their parent, you know, the whole thing. And so the policies being followed to the letter of the law for the first time. Yes, it was, you know, during the Obama administration, they were deporting people left and right, you know, the whole thing. But this is a hard option that we are implementing. And there are people who are shocked and surprised to find out that when you mandate government to be compassionate, this is what you get. Okay. Doesn't matter who's in the White House. Okay. A federal bureaucracy is a federal bureaucracy. And if you tell ICE, by the way, you need to strictly enforce our border sovereignty, the nation's sovereignty, our border law, et cetera. And then, by the way, do it in a compassionate way. You're wasting your time, because government is not good at that. Bureaucracies don't dispense compassion. That's, by the way, that's why when you throw a kid into the state system, into CPS, that's why you get horrible, tragic outcomes, because a bureaucracy with 21 caseworkers smelling the barn of retirement, you know, months away from their pension or years away, and they're trying to cover their ass, that's why you get those horrible outcomes from the agencies that are supposed to be actually literally delivering compassion. And so it's a little crocodile teary when I hear people shocked that that ICE just wants to achieve a goal. And in their PowerPoint, it doesn't say slide one, be compassionate. It says be efficient. Deal with this problem. So then it feeds fuel to the fire of these idiots who say things like abolish ICE, or they equate ICE to the SS because they failed to stay awake in history class. They equate ICE rolling up illegal aliens to the SS going through a ghetto in Warsaw and pulling Jews out. That is absolutely horrific. It's horrific that someone is stupid enough to say something like that, mayor of Tacoma, or and in saying it, that becomes conventional wisdom. I mean, so and this is one of the really most frustrating things is seeing Pramila as taking Jim McDermott's spot in Congress. Because those of us, if you've been in Seattle radio long enough, at some point you had Pramila in studio, and Pramila was a poster girl for illegal alien enablement. Even though she came here legally, she went through the process of coming to this country legally, she would never ever admit that there's such a thing as a sovereign border. And she would never ever admit that a nation isn't a nation unless it can control who comes into its territory. She would never say that. And I've never heard her say it as a congressperson. And now you have people actually equating ICE to the SS. So we're in upside down world. We're in crazy world. And people like the mayor of Tacoma or Pramila or people agitating for the elimination of ICE, you're spraying crazy juice all over. I mean, you're getting it all over us, those of us who actually paid attention in history class. Next hour, charter schools, the billionaires to the rescue. Who knew? And they don't have to. They can send their kids to the snooty side school. I'm not naming names, but they're not. They want you to have the option. We'll be back in just a minute. It is the Jason Rand Show. Brian Suit filling in.